Sometimes it's hard to believe they have problems like we do, in some cases even worse. They, the celebrities and recognizable names whose faces we see on the covers of magazines and tabloids, they seem so successful, so rich, so pretty. How could they truly have problems? Problems like us. Colton Haynes, one of those pretty people, star of Teen Wolf and Arrow, how could he have problems? But just like so many of us, he's had struggles, addiction, abuse, suicide, and issues with his sexuality, all now laid bare in his memoir, Miss Memory Lane. But with hope, a message to queer kids everywhere that they are worthy of love without pain. Today, a full hour with Colton Haynes, and we invite you to join the conversation. 888-486-9677.
Town Square with Ernie Manous is made possible with support from listeners like you. Subscribe to our daily podcast and find episodes at townsquaretalk.org.
Hello, I'm Ernie Manous, and this is Town Square. Actor Colton Haynes is now an open book. An American actor and model known for starring roles as Jackson in MTV's supernatural drama series Teen Wolf, and as Roy Harper, Arsenal, in the CW superhero television series Arrow. And that book, Miss Memory Lane, his memoir that took almost 3 years to write. It's an unflinching, honest approach. He addresses his struggles with sexuality, addiction, loss of his parents, and his hopes for a better future for today's queer youth to live in their truth. Without much further ado, let's welcome to the program Colton Haynes. Hello there, Colton.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
I am well. Thank you for joining us. I want to remind our audience that our phone lines are open for questions, comments at 888-486-9677. That's 888-4-TOWN-SQUARE. So, Colton, you've written the book now. Is it all there, or are there some things you just didn't put in?
I definitely wrote enough to have it be a trilogy, but I'm so proud of what is in the book, and I really feel like without being censored and actually just being able to tell my story just really authentically is something that I'm so happy that I got to do, and I really do hope it helps other people who are struggling.
Yeah, I think about a lot of the work that you have done, and physically your body has been exposed. Is it different, to have your inner thoughts, your feelings, your true story exposed?
Well, that truly is just a feeling of just joy, really. I spent most of my life just always being seen through the lens of other people, and I really just never felt like my feelings were heard or people really even listened to me because they were too busy focusing on my exterior. And so, this book really is that honest truth. And, it is very unflinching and very raw. And it's just something that I'm so proud of because I just finally got to, get everything I wanted to say and also everything I'm feeling onto the page. And I'm really happy about that.
Well, I hope you haven't said everything in the book because we got an hour with you right now. We want you to share a lot of things with us here.
Yeah, I'm definitely an open book, and I'm terrible at small talk, and I'm great at having real conversations, and that's why I'm so happy to be doing this with you.
Okay, then let's jump into something big right off the top, and it's society's obsession with beauty and how it is a currency, how people do value people on their appearance. And as someone who has had that happen to you a great deal through your career, how do you view this topic?
It's such a tricky topic because I think the things that come to mind are, it must be so hard to be, beautiful, and oh, you must have a lot of problems, and that kind of comes up a lot, and the way that people speak about it. And I think that especially in the book, I was just able to really lay that bare and really let people know that it truly was something that was very damaging for me. It is a big part of why I was able to succeed in a career that I love. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that it that being my only currency and having had spent that currency and basically gone bankrupt from spending that currency, really, really, it just was so incredibly damaging for my mental health, because I just, you know, I feel like I just have so many other things that are just a lot more important mm-hmm. for me, and a lot of other things I want to share besides the way that I look. And I think with that in the industry, you do get put in the box, and mm-hmm. and also you do get kind of seen from other people as not having actual problems. And also you do have a lot of people who aren't really interested in listening to what you're saying. And so, yeah, it's definitely, I think it also is kind of on the other side of that. It can be used as, you know, getting away with things. Cause I, you know, I know a lot of people and I've seen a lot of people just not really have to work as hard and mm-hmm. not really have mm-hmm. to dive into their trauma because of the way that they look. And it can be really damaging, and also in some ways, not for me, but can for others can be a get out of jail free card, which is pretty right. infuriating. So
do you remember first realizing that your appearance affected the way people treated you?
Yeah, it was basically like puberty hit me kind of like a truck, and and it definitely, yeah, I mean, it was, I was a shy, effeminate kid, and then puberty happened almost overnight, and I just started looking a lot older, and I think I started getting attention that I never had gotten before, and that I think in many ways became my first addiction, because yeah. I wanted to be seen and to be loved and just to be heard for so many years. And then whenever I started to appear in a way that people started to take a liking to, I started in a way abusing that situation and started using my looks to really get ahead and to get what I wanted. And at a very young age, it started becoming very sexual, and then started blaming myself when I started getting older for the reasons of why I was acting that way. But really, I just didn't understand that it was all attached to childhood sexual trauma and things mm-hmm. like that.
I was going to ask about that, understanding that you were 6 years old when there was sexual abuse. And I wonder if yeah. that stays with you. And when you realize attention as you start, as you said, when you hit puberty, does that then come back as a way to find validation? Does that start setting the trap you're going to get ensnarled in?
Oh, 100%. You know, and I think that it's kind of a recurring theme, especially it, you know, I can definitely say for a lot of queer youth is starting to get validation that way at a young age. And obviously that is just so immoral and so terrible that people would start viewing you that way at a certain age. And mm-hmm. it's also when you're not treated the way, when you feel different and when you don't feel like everybody else, and when you're constantly, you know, being told to be more butch or be more masculine or be like your brothers or be like your friends who play football and things like that, and you just feel like you can't amount to anything, you can't live up to that, you start to really, you dive into where you do find that light and you do find that validation. Mm-hmm. And for me personally, it really was something that I just never realized that I was a child. I always thought I was an adult because I had to take care of myself a lot growing up, mm-hmm. being in a household with alcoholic parent. And, you know, it really, thinking I was 25 years old when I was 14 and starting to do things that 25-year-olds did,
yeah,
definitely set me up for some interesting situations when I got older.
I know you've talked a lot about how this book was cathartic for you and it brought you to face a lot of things from your life and to deal with them now as an adult looking at them. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you can recall or understand as a six-year-old when things are happening to you, when surrounding that, in addition to just the abuse, the almost, in a sense, neglect of your parents because of their own addictions and the problems you're facing there. What goes through a child's mind?
You don't really understand that things are not supposed to be happening the way that they were for me. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what any of that was. And all I knew was that someone had taken a liking to me. And so there weren't feelings that it was something that was wrong. But then noticing that those things weren't things that were happening in public, and also felt a very secretive situation, that started becoming something that I became drawn to, with secrecy and mm-hmm. and you know, hiding and kind of searching for things in the darkness, and really, you know, just that path. And I think that's something that I still have to watch out for, because there are habits that I've continued to seek out whenever I am searching or down that self-sabotage trail that I tend to go down a lot. And so, that's something that I still struggle with.
In having to hide true situations that were happening to you, or to project the image you wanted to project, do you think any of those skills helped you actually to be a better actor?
I definitely do think that helped. And I think it's also, it's become kind of, I think how difficult it was for me to try to start working, I think a lot of people think that just kind of happened overnight and it was just kind of handed to me. And I think it couldn't have been further from the truth. And I still find myself being like, I know that I'm very public. I'm not saying you're doing this, but a lot of people, they don't ever even really remember that I'm an actor, or that I've actually mm-hmm. achieved things in acting, because they're too busy focusing on my personal life, which I do spoon feed to people. And I don't have a problem with being very genuine and offering my life, because I now know that it can help a lot of people. And and I started hiding in the shadows for so long because I was embarrassed about what had happened publicly with I call it my downfall. Mm-hmm. But once I realized that there's not a lot of people speaking about real things that happen, I really started to do that, and it started helping me and also helping other people. But yeah, definitely the life that I had grown up in definitely helped me become an actor, and also gave me that drive to use the negativity around all of it as fuel to keep moving forward. So. Well.
We are going to talk more about the career aspect of it, the accomplishments in your life. We'll also visit a little of the downfalls coming up. We are speaking with actor, model, and author Colton Haynes, and we invite you to join the conversation at 888-486-9677. That's 888-4-TOWN-SQUARE. We're going to take a quick break right now, but we'll be back. This is Town Square on your NPR station, News 88.7. I'm Ernie Manous. We'll be right back. I'm Ernie Manous, and this is Town Square. Actor Colton Haynes is telling the true, unvarnished story of his life in the new memoir, Miss Memory Lane. And he's here with us today answering your questions, 888-486-9677, 888-4-TOWN-SQUARE. And Colton should still be with us. Are you still there, Colton?
Yep, I'm here, yeah.
Okay, question. The title of the book, Miss Memory Lane, M-I-S-S. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I love the title. It's actually, I've always been kind of addicted to nostalgia, and mm-hmm. People always for years have called me Miss Memory Lane, and I tend to be the type of person that holds people hostage with my memories. That's what I always tell people. I'm like, oh, have I been telling you that story for an hour, or like showing you pictures for an hour? And I just feel like people are always kind of clawing to get away from my memories. so I definitely. This was the right time to, then I realized, because I have journals of my mom's and also my grandma's, that I realized that they are Miss Memory Lane as well. And I really wanted to take these memories and, that felt like a map that kind of led me back to myself. And I just wanted to, just make them useful and turn them into something that could possibly help other people.
Yeah. You begin your career doing modeling. at about 15 years old. Mm-hmm. I want to know that this is a true story, that you lied on modeling applications and said you were 5'11", but you're actually 5'8". True or false?
Oh, very 100% true.
Okay, and how did you think you'd get away with that? That's my question, because I'm about 5'9", but maybe more 5'8", and I want to know how to do this.
Yeah. Oh, it's very easy. I could teach a course on, faking your way to trying to be successful. But I knew, because I was like, okay, my parents, they were both taller than 5'8". And so I was like, I'm going to grow. So if they like my look, they're not going to see me if they don't think that I'm exactly the height that they want. And, you know, in this industry, there are kind of limitations, and they're very specific. So I lied and said it was 5'11" when I was actually like 5'7" or 5'8".
Oh, now 5'7". Interesting.
Yeah, it was definitely pretty short under the limit. So they signed me over the phone, and just after sending videos and photographs to them, and they sent me a plane ticket. And then in the summer, I went to live in the model's apartment with eight other guys. And then I showed up to the agency having head stuffed and duct taped socks and like underwear, like rolled up in a ball in the back of my oversized boots. And then I clunked on in, and then they spotted that I was walking like a gazelle, and then they made me take the shoes off. And then they said, if you don't book this week, you're not going to be repped by us. And then I ended up booking Abercrombie that week.
So. Wow. Well, that's awesome. How does then modeling lead to acting?
I mean, it was something people are always telling me, because I have a very specific, I would say at times very unique personality that tends to be a little confusing for people, because they definitely are, I'm kind of silly, and that's definitely not the tone of this book, mm-hmm. but there's a couple lighthearted moments in there, but people, my agents were always telling me that you have to do this, and it's something that I wanted to do, but never really knew how to start. And so I used to think that that was their way of telling me that I was never going to be a model, or like a professional model, because they kept trying to push me towards acting, and it used to make me very angry. Mm-hmm. but no, and then I used being in front of, on modeling shoots, I used that experience in front of the camera to really help bring that emotion onto the screen whenever I moved to LA. And it definitely helped. And it was just, still a passion of mine, is working with photographers and things like that.
One aspect I find very fascinating about your story is the fact that to your friends, to your family, you had come out. You lived as an out gay man. And then Hollywood comes calling and pushes you back into the closet. And I'm kind of fascinated. We all probably think about these, the gay underbelly of Hollywood. There's that book out, Full Service by Scotty Bowers, where he talks about how pretty much every old movie star was gay. There's this whole idea that there's a secret Hollywood and beards and all of this stuff. Do these conversations really happen, where somebody sits you down and says to you, listen, you're gay, you've got to hide it, and this is what you've got to do? How do those kind of conversations play out in real life?
Gosh, I would like to say I hope they're not happening now, but I think mm-hmm. now there's enough cases out there that if someone is trying to look to see if it is still okay to be out in Hollywood, I think there's enough cases out there that kind of prove that to be wrong. Mm-hmm. When I moved to LA, I was wholly myself. I had recently, before I moved, I had done this pretty risque magazine photo shoot for XY magazine. And, I didn't think a lot of these gay qualities and queer qualities about myself were going to hurt my career, because I didn't really know too much about it. And then I signed with a manager basically right when I moved to town, who put me into different speech therapy classes and put me into Movement for the Actor classes, all of which I had to pay for mm-hmm. myself. And, really made me up to be this, to have a package to really sell to people in Hollywood.
And, but take me back just for a minute there
to
the conversation where they sit you down. Are you dehumanized? Do they say, you can't be who you are? You need to be who we've decided you are. How does the actual conversation play out?
Yeah, well, so I knew walking in, because this happened before and when I was modeling, but I knew walking in that there was going to be a distinction between my photographs and the way I present. And so that's something that I'm always aware of. Mm-hmm. And so I walked into the manager's office and, you know, knowing that I was going to have to be singing a musical number from a musical and doing a monologue and things like that. So I was like, okay, if they don't like me in person and they just like me in photographs, at least they'll listen to my talent or hear me and know that I have something to bring to the table besides the way I look. So I started singing. The manager stopped me and said, okay, yeah, stop moving your face so much. And why are you, and you have to straighten up, or like stand up straight and stop blinking your eyes too fast. And basically he was saying everything around the fact of just stop being so gay. Mm-hmm. And it was all within a span of just that first meeting. And then right after that, every time I would try to, do a monologue or something like that in the meeting, he would stop me and say, do you have any other pictures? Do you have any other pictures? And so basically he was saying, okay, yeah, talent, whatever, but that's not going to be your ticket in this town. And so it was extremely dehumanizing. And then, then eventually after they dropped me for saying that I wouldn't succeed and telling me to go, work as a sex worker. I ran into that manager after I had started working and, you know, he had said that it was the biggest mistake that he'd made. It didn't make me feel very good because I just started to think, I hope he's not doing this to other people.
Yeah. Let me remind everyone, this is Town Square. I'm Ernie Manoos. We're talking with actor, model, and author Colton Haynes, and our phone lines are open, 888-486-9677. You mentioned singing a show tune in an audition or in front of management. Talk to me a little about your love of music. I see that that's becoming a bigger part of who you are these days, or at least was.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to school for musical theater because that was something I always grew up doing. And just, I fell in love with musicals and everything like that because of the family that I had made with my musical theater friends. And so it's just always something I love, and I love all types of music. It's such a way of storytelling that I'm so fascinated with. And I really, my heart and like goes out to like artists, because, you know, for actors, we don't have to really, well, I did with my book, you know, I really laid it all out there, but I think that there's still a way to keep some of that to yourself. But with music, it's just really raw. And that's really what draws me to music. And I just love all that.
Yeah. Why the feeling, since you mentioned it, of doing the book and needing to share this story?
Oh, say that one more time.
I was saying, you mentioned the book and needing to share your story when you talk about actors don't necessarily have to do that. Why is that important for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, for me, I've been trying to for so long, and I feel like a lot of times I have 5 to 10 seconds to get my point across or to get out my point, because I feel like either people shut me up or they're just not interested in the things that I have to say. And I grew up with a little bit of kind of a learning attention issue. And so for me, the writing, my thoughts have always been something that have been really impactful for me and have really gotten my point across, because a lot of times I either get a little anxious when I'm speaking or I'm not as confident whenever I'm speaking. And so, with writing this book, I was just able to perfectly communicate how I've been feeling. And that can tend to get a little flustered especially whenever I'm doing things. I did a lot of interviews on this last press tour for the book that were a lot of gotcha questions. And that Yeah, I'm not always the best with that. So that's why I'm really happy that I got to, yeah, get that out there. So
We have no gotcha questions today. So I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
We do have a question.
I feel comfortable with y'all.
Yeah. Oh, good. That came in from Mariana. And she wants to know, did you enjoy your time in Texas?
Oh, Ariana Grande is asking. Oh, my gosh.
No, Mariana, not Ariana Grande.
Mariana. I'm kidding. Oh, it's Mariana. Okay.
Yeah.
What was the question about?
Did you enjoy your time in Texas? You graduated high school here, right? Or went to high school here?
I did. Yeah. I graduated. I spent my senior year of high school in Schertz, Cibolo, Texas, which I went to Samuel Clemens High School, which is outside of San Antonio. And I had preconceived ideas of what Texas was going to be like, and it couldn't have been further from my idea of it. Mm-hmm. It was, I mean, I had such an incredible senior year, and I grew up going to a very, very, living in a small town of 600 people. And then our high school was maybe 200 people. And then I went to this high school in Texas of 3,000 people. And I had one of the most fun years of my life, and it was something I'll cherish, and I really loved living in Texas.
Yeah. So take me into the world of Teen Wolf. What did that feel like and the notoriety that came from it?
Oh, it was pretty intoxicating, to be honest. it was really unexpected for this show that everyone thought was a joke. Mm-hmm. To really hit, and even having it have another resurgence during the pandemic with this newer generation that are finding it for the first time from Netflix or mm-hmm. from online, it's just such a beautiful thing to see, because we were all there really working so hard and becoming this family. And I mean, still to this day, we are so close, every single one of us. And people say that a lot about the cast that they work with, but this is just something, it really is lightning in a bottle, and just something that was and is so special. And the fact that we, 12 years later, just finished the movie for Paramount Plus, the kind of reboot movie, we're getting to have our kind of friends reunion moment. So.
Aren't you guys now at this point kind of stretching the term of the word or the definition of the word teen?
Well, so we're definitely not teens anymore. I can say that. Yeah, we're definitely generation past, a couple generations past. So now we are, I can't give too much away, but we're definitely not teenagers and we're not in high school. Some of us are in high school, but playing in different roles. Is we're not actually students, we're definitely stretching it, and we're going to stretch it for as long as we can.
So you're not pretending to be teens in the new movie?
Not in this new movie. I am currently in my life. I tend to always do that. And if anyone tells me I'm not a teen, I will hear from you. Yeah.
They'll hear from me. I perfectly understand that. Well, we have a question that came in. Yeah, I do too. We had a question that came in from Twitter. Takes a little background to set up, because obviously they're familiar with the book, and that you, near 30 years old, found yourself in the hospital. A whole bunch of things were going on with you. But one of the things was that you lost sight in an eye, or nearly lost sight in one of your eyes. And so Midnight writes us and says, did the eye he lost sight in remain sightless, or did it come back?
It didn't come back fully. I already had pretty bad eyesight to begin with. Mm-hmm. I have like a negative eight. I think that's, or -7.5, -8. And I think, I'm not sure what legally blind is, but I had pretty bad eyesight to begin with, and it didn't come back all the way. So now, it's a lot worse than it was, but luckily I able to still see almost pixels in a way out of it. And then, but I have contacts that help it, that it's not correct fully, but yeah, it's definitely, that's what will happen whenever you bring your body to the absolute death.
Fill the audience in on why you were in the hospital and why all this was going on. Where were you at?
Yeah, I ended up in the hospital because I tend to be the type of person that has to hit every branch on the way down. Mm-hmm. And I'm very stubborn when it comes to, if someone tells me that I have a problem, I in a way was trying to prove to them that I didn't have a problem with drugs and alcohol. And really all that did was hurt me. And so I ended up, after my divorce and after my mom passed away in the same span of 2 weeks, I was put on an involuntary psychiatric hold by a friend who didn't know where they were taking me. And then once I got home, I took a bottle of a couple bottles of pills and ended up in the hospital from an overdose.
Mm. So, for people who hear your story, and the disconnect, I think, for a lot of folks here is that you've got the success in Teen Wolf. You've got the success in Arrow. You are a recognizable actor. You've got the looks. You got the talent. Why do these demons keep plaguing you? What don't they understand?
I think it felt like it was happening to somebody else, and it was happening to my character I created, and it wasn't happening to me. And even. You know, that happened a couple years after I had come out of the closet publicly. And still, after that happened, I couldn't figure out how to break ties with this character that I created. And because people had grown to love that person and grown to lust after that person, mm-hmm. and grown to really find that person to be the person that they wanted to invest their dollars in, and also invest their time and their, you know, their lives in. And so, for me, I just felt so inauthentic and just not genuine at all. And I also didn't feel like I belonged, because in creating this character who is unapproachable and very butching myself up and being more masculine and things like that, I was setting the wrong example for other queer kids who were like, oh, I can be gay in Hollywood if I look and act like him. And once I realized that, it was it was such an emotional thing for me, because I was doing a lot more harm than I thought I was. And mm-hmm. so I think there was a lot going on behind the scenes that really, really brought me just to my depths and really helped tear away that facade of that character that I had created.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take another quick break here. We are talking with actor Colton Haynes. When we come back, Cher, Elton John, and a message to the queer kids of today. All coming up, plus your comments and questions at 888-486-9677, 888-4-TOWN-SQUARE. You can also interact with us and follow us on Twitter using @TOWNSQUARETALK. To ensure you never miss an episode, remember, subscribe to Town Square with Ernie Manous, the podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. This is Town Square on your NPR station, News 88.7. I'm Ernie Manous. We'll be right back. I'm Ernie Manous, and this is Town Square. Coming up on Tuesday's show, the House Select Committee on January 6th continues their public hearings. Tomorrow, our experts will be with us to help navigate the testimony, the narrative, and the newest revelations. That's Tuesday at 3 p.m. Also, last Friday, we were live from Galveston honoring the national holiday, Juneteenth. For those celebrating today, don't forget that you can hear our Juneteenth special. Just look for the Town Square with Ernie Manous podcast, and that episode is there. Today, we're discussing Miss Memory Lane, a memoir of lust, abuse, addiction, stardom, and redemption. And we happen to have its author with us, Colton Haynes, the actor you know from shows like Arrow, American Horror Story, Teen Wolf, and Scream Queens. And our phone lines are open for your calls and questions, 888-486-9677. That's 888-4-TOWN-SQUARE. Okay, Colton, if I ever wrote a book, I would love Elton John to write the foreword for my book. How do you get Elton John to write the foreword for your book?
I was... in shock when, and so Elton's been a very, very, and really great friend of mine for many years. And I was, right after I came out of the closet in 2016, he had posted a picture of us on his Instagram and, you know, just showing his love. And so I basically was asked to ask people if they would like to do a forward, and Elton and his husband, David, were just two that I didn't want to ask because I just felt like they weren't going to get back to me and, you know, they're busy. And 2 days before my deadline for that, I texted them and I was like, look, I know y'all are busy and I'm sure you could ask this a lot. And it was within 5 minutes they responded and then read my book in 2 days while they were both busy and then sent me this beautiful forward. And it really was so emotionally touching for me because to have that support from someone who has been such an iconic person in history and also in LGBTQ plus history has just been, gosh, I mean, that was just such an incredible moment. And I almost didn't ask. So I'm so glad I did.
Okay. True or false? Cher introduced you to the man who became your husband?
Well, no, Cher actually, that's false. So
okay.
Cher, my ex actually, had Cher make a video, basically asking me to marry him. And so it played over this, it was such a wild experience. And so we were in Mexico and, we were watching a movie on this big screen and then Cher popped up. And I was like, what is Cher? Why is Cher? And I was like, this doesn't look like it's in the movie. And then Cher popped up and I was like, what the hell is happening? And it was like the gayest thing ever. And we afterwards got to, you know, go say hi to her and see her a couple times in Vegas. And yeah, it was just such a beautiful experience.
Yeah. And to just finish this off, Kris Jenner married you guys?
Yeah. Gosh. I mean, what an... just such an incredible human being. I mean, Kris, and you know, people can give them a hard time, that family, but I have to say they are every single one of them. Not only are they driven people, they are the nicest people you would meet, and which is not something you would expect in Hollywood. And also just, you know, the success and their drive for things. And, you know, Kris was just she's just such an incredible human being. And we were really lucky, that she got to be there for and help us with that special day. And still to this day, you know, even though things didn't work out, which that's life. I mean, my wedding day was still the most beautiful day of my life. And my mom got to be there and, before she passed away, and it's still a memory I'll cherish forever. And, and it's just nice to not have any animosity and just to really just have such a beautiful memory with Kris and with, you know, my ex and and my whole family.
Yeah. I am curious though, from where you're at now and what you've, all the soul searching that goes into writing a book like this and looking back on the wedding, do you ever fear it was overproduced, that it was too much of an event, or was it a genuine, fully felt event in your life? I don't know how to word that correctly, but I hope you know where I'm going.
My bank account felt it. I'll tell you that. it's definitely not. That is something, and you know, I can obviously joke about it now because I'm on the other side of it, and you know, it's. I have tried very hard to be a fancy person, a Hollywood person, and I'm from Kansas, and it is not that people in Kansas don't have, you know, fancy attitudes and things like that, but I am not one of, I am the least Hollywood person that you would ever meet in your whole life, and I basically still exist on donuts and Pop-Tarts and Doritos and Taco Bell, and so that was not a fun thing for me personally to have, something so lavish, but I also essentially was I was in a blackout, and I didn't really know what was happening, and also there was a lot of things being done that I just wasn't really aware of when it came to a lot of the planning, and mm-hmm. I was just happy that my family got to be there, and a lot of my friends got to be there. And yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful, beautiful thing. But you know, flowers that just a million red roses that just get thrown in the trash after. That's just
and when
not,
you say a million
idea of how
when you say a million red roses, you're probably not exaggerating.
There was a million red roses.
That's insane.
Yeah, and so it was a stunning. It was a beautiful. I mean, my ex is the flower genius of the world. I mean, such mm-hmm. an incredible artist, and it was such a beautifully stunning night. That was worth it to have that type of beauty. But at the same time, I really cherish the memories I have of my family over the flowers any day. So,
you talked earlier about the way they moved you back into the closet, the system did. What got you to come out again?
I basically, it was something that my health was really being affected. And I kept having to go into these different treatments because I became really agoraphobic, and I didn't understand what this fear of life was. And this, every time I would step out of the house, I would feel like I couldn't breathe. And my doctor, who's still my doctor, who I absolutely adore, basically said, I think that your health issues are having to do with stress. And I really think that it has to do with your coming out and, or the fact that you're struggling with all of that. And that, even knowing that it was going to be, that it was going to be pretty, it was going to, I was going to take a, my career was going to be impacted. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know to what extent that was going to happen, but I just knew that it would be something I needed to do so I could still be on this earth, because I had held so much shame around my sexuality and around the secrecy, with the world. And I just felt extremely inauthentic. And so, yeah, that brought me to coming out, and really, really was crucial in me still being here, even to write this book. So,
concern from your management?
Oh, yeah. It concern from everybody, because I always have these ideas going into things that maybe things will be different this time. Mm-hmm. Like maybe I'll be the one exception. Maybe this will start change. And it felt like almost overnight things dried up for me. And there are other factors, and the book is in no way a pity party at all. It's not a smear piece. If anything, it's a smear piece on me. Mm-hmm. And so, getting the opportunities that I get now compared to what I used to get, is they're completely different. You know, I mean, now I'll get auditions to play the gay best friend or the gay dad. And it's 98% of the time, maybe even 99% of the time, it's for a gay role when I had never played a gay role before, which obviously there's nothing wrong with that, because I do think that, you know, gay people should be portraying mm-hmm. gay characters. But my look interferes with the leading role. And they're not going to cast. You can't name one leading male romantic lead who is out. There's no gay Brad Pitt. And so, therefore, I wouldn't book those roles. And so, yeah, definitely took a toll on my career. But at the same time, now I found other outlets and I found my importance in life. And my importance is really, for me personally, is the impact that telling my story has had on kids that have come up to me at conventions, or people that have said that hearing my story has helped them with theirs. And now I've really found, I think I found my superpower in a way. And I think, you know, it, for me, I can't just be quiet and hide in the shadows anymore, because it's not, I wouldn't be using what I was put here to do correctly.
Yeah. One of the beautiful things about your book is the message moving forward for queer kids today. Please address that a little bit.
Yeah, in my dedication, I say something to the effect of, to all the queer kids who long for love and attention, And then I say to the ones who break their own arm, if only to have someone sign their cast, you are worthy of love without pain. And that's a message to queer kids all over who do feel that they aren't worthy of love without pain. And it's also a message to me. And it's something that I needed to tell my younger self. And it was something I need to tell myself every day, because mm-hmm. that pain and that suffering is attached to a lot of love that I really never got growing up. And I still have to check in with myself and remind myself that I am worthy of that love without pain.
When did the realization come to you that that was something you could live by, being worthy of love without pain?
Probably about 6 months ago when I turned in my dedication.
Really?
I was crying in I booked a hotel room on Hotels Tonight, which is like a, you know, a yes. hotel app. And yeah. I was way past my deadline, and I felt like I was, whenever I was finished, I felt like I was going to, that Miss Memory Lane was going to die in a way. And I felt like I was going to have to leave all of that behind. And I didn't want to let my memories go. And so, but I was crying in a hotel room, you know, and I had that realization, and I wrote it down and I sent it in to my editor, and he was like, this is perfect. And he was like, now I understand why you needed extra time, because I know you were really struggling with this. And, yeah, it was really recent. And it is something, I think it'll be a lifelong struggle, but at least I now am able to think clearly and to actually have emotions that I'm not numbing out. And now I'm able to actually check in with myself instead of just try to silence all of my voices. I'm kind of, you know, I'm almost like acting like a conductor to try to turn all the voices in my head into like some sort of symphony that'll at least, you know, help me sing on tune. So yeah, it's recent, but I'm really thankful that I am able to have a lot of the introspection.
In writing the book, do you think you found the answers to the questions you had?
I think I did. And I mean, I still have so many more questions. I definitely would like to have another sit down with myself that I need to be doing every day and continue to ask these questions. But I think the realization, even just with that question, what a great question. Even with that question, I had said once before that it doesn't matter if 5 people read this book. This book is so authentically me, and I'm something I'm so proud of, that obviously more people than 5 will read it, but this is a book that will live on and hopefully help people whenever they need it the most. And for me, it's also something that will help me. And knowing that I was also a factor in helping myself, get to this point, and the strength that I had to endure and go through to actually get sober and to battle all of these demons, really gives me that confidence that I answer questions and that I'm able to answer more that come up.
Yeah. Do you wish now that folks would move beyond this story now and put you back in their mind as the actor, as opposed to the author of this memoir?
No, I don't. I just, at this point, want people to be authentically themselves, and I want people to not have to hide behind a character. Mm-hmm. And I want to be seen as me in whatever facet that is.
Well, Colton, this hour flew by way too fast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Colton Haynes, he's author, actor, model. You can find his memoir, Miss Memory Lane, wherever books are sold. You can also connect with him on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for @ColtonLHaynes. And keep an eye out for Teen Wolf the movie, coming soon to Paramount Plus. And you can also remember to follow us over on Twitter @TownSquareTalk as well. Remember, tomorrow at 3 o'clock, we are going to have a follow-up to tomorrow's hearings from the January January 6th committee. So we hope you'll join us for that, for the insight and understanding. And remember, you can always reach us by email, talk@townsquaretalk.org. For Houston Public Media, I'm Ernie Manous. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Town Square with Ernie Manous is a production of Houston Public Media. The opinions expressed by guests and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff, management, or underwriters of this station. Medical opinions should not replace consultation with a medical professional.